From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two high-profile deadly shootings last month did not convince the Senate to take up gun reform legislation. And today, President Biden said whether or not Congress asks, he will. He has tools and will use them, including new executive orders. Here he is speaking in the Rose Garden.
I asked the Attorney General and his team to identify for me immediate, concrete actions I could take now without having to go through the Congress. And today I'm announcing several initial steps my administration is taking to curb this epidemic of gun violence.
Biden also announced that gun safety advocate David Chipman would lead the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow is here. And Scott, we know gun control groups have lobbied the Biden administration for weeks now for more aggressive regulations. What exactly will these orders do?
Yeah, a couple different things. One would seek to curb these kits that allow people to assemble what are called ghost guns, guns you make yourself and therefore you don't need to purchase in stores where there are more background checks and regulations in play. The second rule would put more regulations on stabilizing braces, equipment that you add to pistols to make them act more like rifles. They're more accurate. These was used in a recent mass shooting. Certainly more limited than what Congress could pass. I think we're going to talk about that. But a lot of anti-gun violence groups praise these moves. It is worth emphasizing rules like this do take a while to go into effect, to be formally drafted and approved. So it'll be a while before those kick in.
Right. And advocates did want more universal background checks and assault weapons ban. So what does this say about what the Biden administration can do since Congress is deadlocked?
And you may remember a few weeks ago in that first press conference, President Biden irritated some of these groups by seeming to imply that he didn't view preventing gun violence as a priority on the level of infrastructure. But Biden has supported a lot of different measures in the past, and today he was pretty forceful on this issue, ticking off specific things he wants Congress to pass, like an assault weapons ban, it's expanding background checks, ending immunity from lawsuits for gun manufacturers. He said that for him is the most important step that could be taken. And this is a real growing theme of the Biden administration. He was addressing Republican unwillingness to take these measures up by saying, even if Republican lawmakers in Congress don't want to do this, these things are broadly popular with people throughout the country, according to a lot of public opinion polls.
Right. And then there's David Chipman. He actually worked for the ATF for 25 years before becoming a gun safety advocate. What more do we know about him?
Yeah, a longtime high-profile supporter of more gun control measures. He works at Giffords, the anti-gun violence group founded by former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Giffords was actually in the audience today at the White House for this event. In fact, President Biden, when it ended, ran over to the front row to greet her, give an elbow bump. He jumped. He joked that he was told not to do that because the administration is so careful about pandemic safety. But, I mean, she's clearly probably the most high-profile person in the conversation about gun control, and this is a top ally of hers.
We should say President Biden is also trying to address gun violence through his huge infrastructure and jobs plan. It includes $5 billion to support community-based violence prevention programs. What would that do?
And this is something that actually Attorney General Garland said today, that he's directing the Department of Justice to start giving out grant money for similar programs already. A lot of different types of programs that focus on different kinds of interventions, you know, looping mental health and social services in more, having advocates who go and talk to people at risk for committing gun violence. In short, these are approaches to try and stop shootings before they happen.
Yeah. And speaking of deadlocked Senates and this infrastructure bill, we know that Democrats hope that they could perhaps get it through without having to negotiate with Republicans through all sorts of, rules changes. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin put out an op-ed last night saying, no, I want bipartisanship. I'll never vote to eliminate or weaken the filibuster, which would include Republicans. Just quick, how's Washington reacting to that?
You know, I think it's no surprise, despite some cryptic comments in between, Manchin has said all along that he was very unwilling to vote for changes. And of course, you would have to get Senator Sinema from Arizona on board as well. I think gun bills are a good example of something that just can't get passed in a reconciliation package. Infrastructure probably can if Democrats stay together.
Yeah. NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow, thank you.
Thank you.
Conflict in Afghanistan has raged almost without stop for the past 40 years. For about half that time, the U.S. and other allied nations have been fighting the Taliban. All sides are accused of inflicting casualties. But late last year, Australia found that some of its soldiers might have committed war crimes. They belonged to Australia's most elite forces, and a military inquiry implicated 19 of them in the murders of more than two dozen Afghans. As the Australians investigate, more Afghans are coming forward, hoping for justice. NPR's Dia Hadid has more in this report that first aired on Morning Edition.
Ras Muhammad Dost lives in Surkh Murghab, a village in Afghanistan's southern Uruzgan province. It's an area controlled by the Taliban, so producer Khwaga Ghani and I reached him over a fuzzy WhatsApp line.
Assalamu alaikum.
We wanted to hear what happened to his family 12 years ago, when he was just a boy. He says he was sleeping on a mat in a room crowded with relatives. He remembers the shudder of heavy vehicles zooming up to their home.
I remember them screaming. I remember the dogs barking. I remember when they hit the door.
His uncle Morla thought they were being attacked and rushed out with his weapon. He didn't know they were elite Australian forces. They exchanged fire. Then the soldiers threw two grenades into the house. They killed three boys and two girls, a two-year-old and a teenager. The uncle Morla also died of his injuries. Six family members killed, most of them children.
This woman claims she survived an attack by Australian soldiers.
Doss says they never found out why they were attacked.
We're not the enemy. We're not insurgents. We're only farmers.
Doss' family is among the half a dozen we spoke to who allege their loved ones were unjustly killed by Australian forces. They've come forward now, years after these incidents occurred, to give new witness statements to local human rights organisations, even though the Australian military had previously looked at and dismissed these cases.
That's because the Afghanistan inquiry identified that there were serious problems with the military's investigation.
Rawan Araf is the director of the Australian Centre for International Justice. She's referring to the military inquiry that investigated the alleged war crimes. That inquiry investigated dozens of cases, and it identified 23 incidents as potential war crimes. It has referred them on for further investigation and possible prosecution. The case of the Dost family might be one of those. But the military inquiry was heavily redacted, so it's not clear which incidents are being investigated.
We would hope that the Afghan victims whose complaints were heard previously and they were dismissed, that this would be a chance for them now where criminal investigators are actually looking at these incidents and hopefully undertaking a more serious job.
Experts say it could take up to a decade to look at just the cases the inquiry identified. Many of them involve the killing of unarmed civilians and captive detainees, which means they could include the case of Haji Khan's brother. One day in 2012, helicopters swooped around Haji Khan's village of Sarkhamayolia. Australian forces came for his brother, Haji Sardar. He was about 65 then. That day, he was building a mud brick wall.
His hands and feet were in mud. The choppers came and these people come out and they shoot him. They pick him up on their shoulder.
Haji Khan says they carried his brother through the village and dumped him near the mosque. And there, he alleges, they killed him. It wasn't the only killing. He and other villagers allege Australian forces raided the village multiple times and killed other young men.
The things they did here, a human being can never think of doing stuff like that.
Haji Khan wants to testify in court about his brother's case, but experts say Australian investigators will likely rely on military whistleblowers, partly because many of the Afghan witnesses live in Taliban-held territory and are difficult to reach. And a former Australian war crimes investigator, Graham Blewett, says it could also be a model for other countries that fought alongside the US and Afghanistan.
Australia doing this is a fantastic example and showing clear leadership to the rest of the world. But if we screw it up, what signal does that send? It just adds to the impunity that currently exists for these people.
The US, which has the biggest foreign military force in Afghanistan, has prosecuted a few individual cases. But former President Trump pardoned two army officers, one who was set to stand trial in the killing of a suspected Afghan bomb maker. The other was convicted of murder. And that's raised questions of whether the American judicial process really offers justice to Afghan victims. Afghan human rights lawyer Farishta Abbasi says while all parties in the Afghan war have committed atrocities, including the Taliban, she says it's foreign forces that have to be held to account urgently because they're leaving.
Once international troops withdraw from Afghanistan, they're trying to forget Afghanistan. The international community is tired of Afghanistan. They're exhausted with Afghanistan.
But Haji Khan, who says his brother was killed by Australian forces, says he can't forget. All these years on, he says all he wants is his day in court. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
If you're looking for music to soothe your spirit, Rhiannon Giddens is here for you. The Grammy winner and founding member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops recorded a new album with her partner, Francesco Turisi. The album reaches back in time and puts a new spin on traditional songs like this fiddle tune called Waterbound.
Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree. Chickens crowing in an old pine tree down in North Carolina. Waterbound and I can't get home. Waterbound and I can't get home. Waterbound and I can't get home down in North Carolina.
The album is They're Calling Me Home and it drops tomorrow. Rhiannon Giddens joins me now. Welcome. It's such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I want to start with that song, Waterbound, and those lyrics, Waterbound, and I can't get home down to North Carolina. They have so much resonance now in this year of the pandemic. How has this year of isolation been for you?
Oh, you know, I can't really complain. I'm in a place in my life, in my career, where enforced downtime hasn't been necessarily all a bad thing, but just the whole, you know, witnessing everything in the States, the pandemic, just seeing all the terrible things. It's been hard, but I can't even pretend to say that it's been as hard as I know it's been for a lot of people.
Yeah. You've been living in Ireland, in Limerick, but you are from North Carolina. Have you felt homesick in the past year?
No, for sure. I mean, it really makes you understand the difference between being, you know, in a home away from home, being able to visit your home country anytime you want and not being able to do that is pretty different. And it's really made me think a lot about the differences between expats, immigrants, and like refugees. You know, they're all very different experiences of being in a country that you didn't grow up in.
Let's hear some more music from the album. There are several mournful songs here to listen to. This one is Calling Me Home. It's written by Alice Gerard.
An old friend lay on his dying bed, held my hand to his bony breast, and he whispered low as I bent my head, oh, they're calling me home, they're calling me home.
Alice Gerard has said that for her, that song is about pain, homage to one's elders and to the stories that they tell. What do you think about that? And why did it resonate with you?
It resonated with me because it's just such a true song. What I found is, you know, as we were, I'm, you know, kind of locked down, and this song, Calling Me Home, just kept coming and wanting to be sung. I found myself so comforted, oddly enough, by the truth in this song. I mean, it's really all about the inevitability of passing on, but facing that, you know? It is about pain, but it's about acceptance of that pain, and I just thought it was really beautifully written.
It is such a dirge, and I don't know if you feel this way, but it kind of reminded me of The Parting Glass, speaking of being in Ireland. A song you're pretty much guaranteed to hear at an Irish wake. How have you been reflecting on death over the past year?
Well, I mean, this music has been helping me. You know, I think that we have separated ourselves from death in a lot of ways. You know, just the way that we deal with it and the way that we don't have to deal with it in some ways. You know, you no longer lose half your children before they reach the age of 5. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
We are so spoiled. And so I think that it's come as quite of a shock. It's like, oh, you know, actually, we're no different than the rest of humanity. We have to grapple with these things. And I think these old songs are really a good way to do that. It kind of connects us to those generations past to, you know, have already dealt with this. So it's like, oh, we're not alone, actually, you know?
Right, right, right. And here's another one of those old songs. Oh, Death. Very different sound, similar theme.
Oh, oh, death. The sinner looked around and began to cry, said, oh, no, death, I'm not ready to die, singing, no.
While the first one we listened to felt like it had roots in Ireland, this one sounds like it's coming right from the American South.
Absolutely, and, you know, the version that most people, or a lot of people are familiar with is Ralph Stanley's version from O Brother, Where Art Thou, you know, which turned on a whole generation to the idea of American roots music. This version, there are obviously more African-American stylistic pieces to it, and I got it from Bessie Jones, and it just really spoke to me. And when I was performing it, when I was recording it, I was definitely reaching deep and feeling a connection. You know, that's exactly what I was saying earlier about that connecting to the ancestors, connecting to the generations that came before. It's like, this is deep, deep, deep stuff, you know, and those old songs really handle it better than any other thing. That's why they're still around. They really grapple with these things, like, in a perfect way.
Do they make you feel better?
Yeah, it's weird, right? Like,
it is.
It's something about listening to sad songs or songs that are really intense that do make you feel better, you know? Every culture has these songs that are laments. And it's like, why would you even do a lament if it did make you feel better? You know, otherwise you're just going to want to go lay down in a river and never get up. So
you're wallowing, yeah.
Yeah. What I think it does is it kind of releases some of those feelings that you have. You kind of experience them through the song. And then at the end, you know, you're a little bit lighter.
You have a couple of Italian songs here. Let's listen to one of them. This is Nena Nena, which you sing with your partner, Francesco Torisi.
Nena, 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 lupa, sarielo in tala vena. Si nun luva para tutta la vena sadda magna.
I understand that song is something that Francesco would sing to his daughter as a lullaby when she was a little girl. What has working with him recently brought to your music?
It's really brought a kind of a zoom out idea, you know? I've been so focused on, you know, African-American parts of American music and finding out it's just American music and it's just made up of all these different things. And then Francesco brings his perspective of coming from a Southern Italian family and then seeing the effect that, you know, Arabic culture and North African and Mediterranean culture had on Europe. And it's a thing that's kind of similarly suppressed, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic to African-American, you know, influence in American music. So there's a sort of a parallel story, and it just really connects me to the wider world and the idea that these stories are not happening in a vacuum. You know, before the transatlantic slave trade, there was the trans-Saharan Arabic slave trade. Before, you know, there was this, there was that. And so it's been really amazing to connect with him and just kind of explore all those connection points.
Well, to that point on connectivity, I want to go out on this last song on the album, your version of Amazing Grace. That song blew me away because I was expecting something completely different. We hear your voice, but you never sing the lyrics, even though they're so iconic. Why not?
Yeah, that's why, right? Because everybody knows them. And so what it does, and this is, look, this is not what I was thinking when we did this. We did this and it was a total feeling. It was instinctive. It was emotional, you know. And then afterwards, you know, in terms of putting it on the record and thinking and ending it with it, it was like, well, everybody can then form their own experience of the song without the words. And there's so much weight to it that it then sort of allows everybody to engage the way they want to with it. I don't know. I was really happy with the way it turned out. We did it all live, bagpipes, yeah, voice, drum, all in one room. You know, couldn't hear myself. It was amazing, you know. And that feeling is what I want people to feel.
Well, we're feeling it, let me tell you that. And I just wonder also what that song, what that traditional song means to you personally now in this year of illness that we've been talking about, but also in this year of a racial reckoning that the United States has been grappling with.
Yeah, man, it's been tough. It's been really, really tough. And overall, the idea of coming through something to the other side, whether it's death or a cultural transformation or a historical reckoning, the thing that has to happen is we have to come together. We have to see each other for who we are and be accepting of that. And it's hard. It's really, really hard. And it has so many different levels and layers and all of it's so intertwined. But, you know, that's all I can contribute to is to try to put something out there that adds to that kind of energy, you know, of reconciliation, of coming together, of all of that. So, yeah, it's been a lot.
Rhiannon Giddens, her new album with Francesco Torisi is They're Calling Me Home. Rhiannon, it is so, so good. Congratulations, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
The Los Angeles Unified School District is now temporarily offering full-time employees $500 a month for every child they have under the age of 6. That money's supposed to pay for childcare. And the district is one of a number of employers around the country rethinking benefits for working parents at a time when many women have had to drop out of the workforce. And as we know, in this country, most of the weight of caregiving still falls on women. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter.
And what is the range of benefits you're seeing out there that, that companies are starting to offer?
Well, so as you said, they're addressing a few issues. One is that, first of all, we're going to start getting jobs back, and companies need to compete for workers, or certainly will in the next year and a half to two. And child care and sort of elder care even is becoming a big, big issue. It was already an issue before the pandemic. We knew the system was kind of broken. It's more broken now. And this is an opportunity for companies to sort of try and build something in that most other modern democracies have. America is way behind everybody else in terms of child care. What you are seeing, though, is that it's changing. It's not just on-site physical child care that companies are talking about. It's also the idea of benefits to pay for child care more flexibly in case you're, you know, working from home or something like that.
Well, that is a big deal. Now, we have been reporting for months how tough this pandemic has been on women in the workforce. They're leaving the workforce in droves because life has changed so much that someone's got to take care of the kids. What does that mean for these companies? How much does it hurt them? I mean, what are they seeing out there that's causing them to realize they got to fix this problem?
It's a couple of problems because every company in America, around the world, is now thinking about what the workplace of the future looks like and flexible work and attracting more people. And again, this is a shock to the system. Our higher unemployment, 6% now, is not natural, right? It's because of the pandemic. So there's an expectation that when it comes back, and it might take a year and a half or two, it comes back fully, companies want to be able to pay for workers. So as you and I have talked about, there's been an increase in wages that a lot of companies are offering well in advance of what the government mandates, because they know they've got to create better places to work. So they're looking at that, but there's also a push now from President Biden to include caregiving as part of a broader infrastructure package, which is unheard of. You don't normally think about caregiving as part of infrastructure, but even the government's thinking about it right now. So it looks like we've sort of turned a page and are saying, how do we keep women more involved in the workforce and get back those who aren't there?
Good point. Some of these companies are doing this on their own, and the government is also considering making it more official. So the LA schools benefit that I mentioned, that would last through the summer for people. So how likely is it that we'll see a meaningful and permanent change here, Allie, you know, once we get out of this pandemic?
Well, a company that surveys these things talked to 200 HR executives, and they said 84% of companies are offering workers more flexibility generally. So that's work hours, that's where you're working from, but specifically in response to workers' caregiving obligations. Two out of the five of those 200 companies, two out of five were reporting that they specifically have extended greater flexibility to parents. 25% said more paid time off. 13% said more childcare solutions. So I think this is going to be permanent. I think everybody's trying it out for now because we're still not sure when everybody gets back to work, given that the pandemic is continuing, but I think you're seeing a meaningful change that might last.
A lot has changed in the past year or so. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Allie Velshi, thank you so much, as always.
My pleasure.
Today is day 9 of the Derek Chauvin trial for murder in the death of George Floyd. Have you been watching? If so, have you been feeling unsettled? A video showing a white policeman's knee on a black man's neck as that man dies. A Greek chorus of bystanders having to control growing rage and despair. Then, as witnesses during the trial, weeping at the helplessness they felt. Well, our next guest says felt is the operative word there, that this is trauma felt at the cellular level, that it then moves in and lives there. And if you are black and brown, it joins a community of past traumas, a physical manifestation of racism that we're only beginning to acknowledge. Resma Menakem is a Minneapolis-born and raised author and therapist whose work centers around racialized trauma, explaining it, healing it. His book is My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. Over the last year, he's worked with the Minneapolis Police Department, as well as that city's public health department. So, Resma Menakem, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, my pastor, Reverend Dan, of First Congregational, mm-hmm. Cambridge, used your work as the centerpiece of his Easter Sunday sermon. You know, Easter is so much about the body, the metaphor for some of the body risen. Your work is about the body held down. Talk about that.
Well, it is about the body held down, but it is also about the body rising, right? It's about how do we connect with the creative resource that is inside of all of us, that is connected to creation itself. And so part of what happens when we go through something like this is that it doesn't just affect the person that that has been brutalized, that has been murdered, that has been hung, that has been lynched. It also affects those that are left, those that are in that person's community. The purpose of doing something like what Derek Chauvin did on camera is to not create terror in the person that he was murdering, but also create terror in the community that was left. This is a long history, a long historical trope of murdering black bodies and indigenous bodies and then leaving them in the public in order to instill racialized terror and trauma.
And by the way, this idea of trauma being passed down, maybe even unspoken, but somehow passed down,
yep.
It affects different populations. I mean, children
That's
of Holocaust
exactly right.
survivors, you know, but we're talking about black and brown here because in Minneapolis, there's been so much trauma. Philando Castile, who told police he was carrying a gun legally, He was shot and killed inside his car. There were other shootings. Of course, George Floyd. So what are you seeing in the people, in the bodies in Minneapolis?
Yeah, people are trying not to watch a lot of it. They're watching chunks or pieces of it, which I really suggest to do. People are reaching out to one another. They are trying to gather what I call wailing homes, places where as this stuff starts to pour out, there's places where people can go and rock and be with each other. And and because when this stuff happens, it is not just happening in terms of just the George Floyd case. There is also the historical energy that never got reprieve or dealt with. There's the intergenerational. There's the persistent institutional. And then our own personal pieces all get combined in together. And we have this sense of overwhelm and this sense of dread and this sense of communal overwhelm and dread.
Well, look, this is some of the work that you're doing with the Minneapolis Health Department. You've also in the past worked with police officers. And by the way, you come from a family of police officers. And you tell a story of one officer, happened to be a white one, who walked up to you and ended up with tears in his eyes. What did you learn about trauma and police officers?
Police officers come from a society. They come from the same society I come from, right? So there are certain things that are embedded in a society with regard to policing black bodies, policing indigenous bodies. And so one of the things that I realized is that they are very rarely educated on the impact of secondary trauma and vicarious trauma. And so there is no infrastructure in the policing departments across the country that actually puts a eye on that, that says early on that we know that our police officers are going to be traumatized because this is a traumatizing structure. So what we're going to do is not just put a gun on their hip and train them, but we're actually going to get them to begin to learn about how to explore and lean into their bodies. And we're going to create an infrastructure by which the sergeants and the lieutenants and the people in command's job is to regularly check on their people, specifically for trauma, specifically around racialized trauma, and specifically around secondary and vicarious trauma. That does not happen right now.
Well, and this officer, you know, his eyes started tearing up when he was just tight as a coil and filled with rage. And he thought something was wrong with him. And, he said to you, nobody's ever said to me that this could happen to me.
Right.
He thought something was wrong with him.
Mm-hmm. A rage is anger that has aged. And many times when that anger gets aged, people lose the plot line. They don't have a sense of where it came from. So they actually act it out on people that they love or people that they serve.
Well, and, you know, this idea of this sense of trauma being passed down through generations, we rarely talk about it, but it's somewhere in the DNA that people know that American policing was born during slavery. Groups of men used to track down runaway slaves. And then after slavery, police looked the other way at lynchings or worse, were members of the Klan. I mean, this is what you're talking about. It's all like in our cells. I encourage people to read My Grandmother's Hands. But in the meantime, what would you tell them now? We're in a trial and there's going to be a verdict. How else can people reduce maybe they don't want to reduce it, somehow do something with this thing that's happening to their bodies?
So the thing that's happening to your body, to our bodies, is actually, like you've been saying, is actually a pass down, right? It's what we learn not from instruction from what our parents do or don't do. It's what we learn from what our parents and our parents' parents recoiled from and leaned into. And so to deal with that type of stuff, one of the things I say is that we got to make time to reach out and check and talk with people. One of the things I always say is, check on your strong family members. Check on your strong friends, because this stuff is communal. And maybe you may think that they're all right and they're the people that everybody goes to, but they're the people that's struggling. We have to realize that this thing may actually have anniversary remembrance to it. So the person that is struggling with it, that may not be struggling with this right now, but a year from now, when the anniversary of the verdict comes up, the fact that they didn't have what they needed to have in order to stop this murder from happening, those things have anniversaries to them for like 1 to 3 years, and some for some people 10, 20 years. There is a tail to it. There is a remembrance to it. We want to be able to help our people, not just now, but later on down the line.
Well, Rasma Menakem, I'm sure you're working with the city to prepare for a not guilty verdict. You say you've used the word murder, but of course the jury is going to decide that. What are you in the city thinking?
Yeah. So I've been talking with a lot of people, and the thing for me is that whether or not the jury comes back with a just verdict, we know what we saw. In an embodied sense, we know what we experienced. So what I saw was a modern day lynching. And what I've been doing, and what a lot of people in my community, other healers in my community have been doing, is preparing for that, is creating, figuring out how do we create ways to address that? How do we come together? How do we open up our homes? How do we create workshops online? How do we do things? How do we write? How do we begin to do this now? So as this verdict comes out, whatever it is, we have some preparation for the amount of historical, intergenerational, persistent institutional and personal pain and terror and horror that's going to be sparked up, whatever the case. Whatever happens, there's going to be a lot of pain that comes through this.
And you're saying there has to be a way to release it structured by people like you, or
People like me, or the grandmother who sees the pain in her baby's eyes and says, come here, let me rock with you.
That's therapist and author Rasma Menakem talking about racialized trauma, which he says all Americans are suffering, but particularly people of color, and especially at this time. Rasma, thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
Violence rocked Belfast, Northern Ireland, for a fourth straight night yesterday. Rioters there throwing gasoline bombs, fireworks, and rocks at police in scenes that recall a period of sectarian violence known as the Troubles. That was a bloody, decades-long conflict between loyalists who wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom and Republicans who wanted to join the Republic of Ireland. Those old divisions, which also pit Protestants against Catholics, are still simmering in Northern Ireland as the reality of a divided UK under Brexit sets in. The BBC's Chris Page joins us now from Belfast. And Chris, what have you seen there in Belfast the last few nights?
Well, in Belfast the last few nights, there's been, I suppose, the most sustained period of street violence in Northern Ireland than there has been for quite some years. Last night, the violence was particularly concerning for many people because it happened near what is called a peace line. Now, although there wasn't much peace going on there last night, but the purpose of the peace lines, they were barriers built during the long conflict here known as the Troubles, which went on for 30 years in the late 20th century to keep people of differing political opinions, I suppose you could say, apart, to try to stop them clashing, try to stop trouble breaking out. There hasn't been any violence around any of those structures, and there are dozens of them across Northern Ireland, really for quite a number of years. But last night, violence did break out in a part of West Belfast, where unionists, loyalists are on one side of the wall, and Irish nationalists, Irish Republicans, are on the other side. So petrol bombs, bricks, other missiles were hurled to and fro over that wall for a period of several hours.
History there, very, very complicated, and the loyalties between those two groups that you just laid out, very deep. We don't have time to get into it all, but what does explain the last burst of violence that we're seeing now? What's triggered this?
Well, until that burst of violence at the peace wall in Belfast for seven nights previously, the violence that had happened in various parts of Northern Ireland, the rioting had mainly happened in loyalist areas. Now, a number of reasons at play. Firstly, there is Brexit. Under the Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland, well, Northern Ireland has basically stayed in the European single market for goods, then the rest of the UK has left. What's that meant in practice is that there's now checks on goods coming here from the rest of the UK. And to loyalists, while it all might sound very technical, that is something that undermines their British identity. They see it as a border, cutting them off economically, in a sense, with Britain. So that's one factor that's contributed to rising unease in loyalist areas. Another, rather more complex, last week prosecutors here decided not to take action against a number of well-known Irish Republican politicians who last summer attended a funeral along with about 2,000 others of a man who was a former paramilitary leader. Now, many people thought that was blatantly in breach of the coronavirus regulations that prevented large crowds from gathering, but because prosecutors decided not to take action against those Republican politicians. So that led to more anger amongst loyalists. Also, though, loyalist paramilitary organisations tend to be really organised crime gangs involved in prostitution, for example, involved in the drugs trade. And there's been a sustained police crackdown over the last number of years against those gangs. So people thought there might be some kind of violent backlash against that to some degree at some stage.
On the issue of Brexit, isn't this exactly the type of violence that people warned about for years during the Brexit negotiations? Is there a sense of we should have seen this coming, or I told you so?
You do certainly get people in Northern Ireland, particularly politicians who were opposed to Brexit, saying that they had warned very much that Brexit could upset delicate political relationships in Northern Ireland, lead to outbreaks of violence on the streets. Though really for a lot of the Brexit process, the focus was on the potential for Republican violence if new border posts had to be put up on the border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. As it is, the way Brexit has turned out, loyalists perceive that there is a border now between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. So we're seeing an upsurge in tension in loyalist areas and now, unfortunately, an upsurge in street violence in loyalist areas.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has come out. He's condemned this violence. From what you can see there on the ground, Chris, does this feel like the beginning of a long conflict, or is there a political solution that could tamp it down?
That is a very significant question. It feels to me that certainly police officers are worried that the violence could escalate. I don't think anybody is really contemplating that full-scale conflict could break out here once again. But that's not to say that things could not become more ugly on the streets. So the minister in the British government with responsibility for Northern Ireland, Brandon Lewis, is holding talks with the main political parties. So certainly people will be looking for a political lead to try to ease those tensions. But for now, as I say, the security forces do have concerns about what may come over the coming days.
The BBC's Chris Page reporting from Belfast. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
And we do hope that situation gets under control quickly. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.